We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here looking in the mirror.
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
What's up, dude? My name is Stephen Godfrey. Thank you for listening. I'm checking my levels, which I should have done before I started. Kind of sang through that one. My name is Stephen Godfrey at 38 Godfrey. This is Split Zone Duo at Split Zone Duo. This is the single wing. If for some reason you were not with us last week for the first all free single wing, normally this is a subscription product. Over at splitzoneduo.com. You can become a subscriber over at our Substack, splitzoneduo.com today. But May, if you didn't know, is Mental Health Awareness Month. So we are partnering with Magic Mind. You can go to magicmind.com/splitzone20, splitzone20, magicmind.com/splitzone20 for 20% off your inaugural run with Magic Mind. I'll talk about them in a second, but we thank Magic Mind for helping sponsor this month's all free. We got four of them, single wings, coming to you in the month of May for Mental Health Awareness Month. Yeah, so if you've for some reason missed the episode before, or you're a veteran here, we're going to do football first. We'll do all the other stuff second. If you would like to ask a question, if you're wondering, how could I ask a question, you become a subscriber over at splitzoneduo.com. I was a little long in the intro last week, so I'm going to try and snap to it. Also, several of you pointed out that I just sort of offhanded was like, you know, it won't be a long episode. We're not going to go that long, referencing previous long episodes, and I think I clocked it. It was about 2 hours, wasn't it? I'm sorry. I don't know. You catch hell when they're 40 minutes. You catch hell when they're 2.5 hours. We have a contingent of heavy drivers. I don't know what the contingent is. I don't know if it's 10%. I don't know if it's 40%. I doubt it's that much. But shout out to my buddy Stitch, professional trucker. We have people who drive a lot. And if I go long and get a little verbose, I'm just keeping them company. I'll know it's bad I don't even know if our Reddit's still active. Maybe that's not a good one. If there's some community dedicated to just giving the synopsis, that's when you know maybe you've run afoul on length. Oh, welcome to May. Welcome to hopefully warm and sunny weather. I mean, at this point, regardless of where you're listening to this, surely you're out of it by now. Surely. We're going to jump in to do college football. Christopher, happy with a one-word answer here, yes or no. Based on what you hear in the industry, is UCF now seen as a good enough job to poach a sitting Power 4 head coach in this upcoming cycle, independent of whatever reason took Gus out of the picture? Well, I could give a one-word answer, but I mean, welcome to the single wing. Yes, but I don't want you to think this way, Christopher. Also, what's happening to Gus? What you doing there, pal? That, I don't want to tip my hand. That Gus scenario reminds me that I have started, I don't really have like a fancy name, like kind of the working list of what I will enter carousel season with. And the way that I do that is that I go, this time of year, I don't talk to coaches or assistants in the rumor mill. I talk to agents first. And here's why. Agents that I trust are not going to waste time prepping candidates in their representation, in their bullpen, for jobs they think won't open. So what's a better way for me to say that? If you have candidate X and you feel like job Y is going to open, you feel like X would be good at Y, you're going to spend some time prepping the candidate, talking to media about, hey, you know, if this happened, Coach Y would be a good person for this position. And then also, you want to have a good idea of the entire lay of the land because of the cascade of, well, this might open, which means this guy might go there, and then his old job would be perfect for my guy, right? So the Gus, the whole, you know, Gus being out of the picture, that just kind of jogged my memory. I'm not sharing it yet, not because I'm trying to be aloof or coy or something. It's because I want to, I take it around to multiple agents and talk with them and then sort of see, you know, what correlates and overlaps the most is what I feel most confident in. And then also, it's freaking May, you bunch of degenerates. At least let me get to July. That's when I start to feel confident about setting a table for a calendar. This is minus any of your, like, you know, Mel Tucker, Hugh Freeze, Patty Fitzgerald, et cetera, and so on. If none of that happened, we would have, you know, a clean table set for starting in August in practice. That's probably when we'll do it. I don't know. It's early. Stop asking me about it. You didn't. Is UCF okay, I don't want you to think this way, Christopher. I don't want you to think this way at all. Yes, it could poach a sitting P4 head coach in this upcoming cycle. Again, I don't know what you're doing to Gus Malzahn. He seems very happy there. Everything seems very good. Why would you do that? Why? Why poach? Is it because you saw the Miami, Oregon, Notre Dame, LSU, Oklahoma, USC soap opera, you know, 2-odd years ago? You don't have to do that to make an impact. In fact, that those chain of schools I just mentioned from 2 cycles ago, it'll probably be 2 more years before we can go, worked out, didn't work out, worked out, didn't work out. I think that UCF full stop is just a good job. And you don't have to worry about, could we poach it? Could we poach this guy or get this guy? Maybe, probably, whatever. What do I mean by that? I mean that, I'll give you an example. If Gus had retired or just decided he was done last year, and a job like Mississippi State didn't open when it did or something like that, Jeff Lebby could have easily been at UCF. There's a number of guys. Sean Lewis, I think, would have been at UCF instead of San Diego State. Lewis interviewed at UCF. Those are the two off the top of my head. I know Lebby and Lewis. So you don't have to think about, oh, it's got to be a sitting head coach. I think UCF is a job where you can get a premier offensive coordinator who's maybe stuck around and not done the whole G5 head coaching thing to wait and hit that ceiling that we've talked about in previous episodes. I think you're going to be able to attract a big name talent that, look, you are recruiting the state of Florida, and I don't want to get into the semantics of this. You are now recruiting at a level that is not the level you occupied really your entire history up until like 3 years ago. Are you Florida and Florida State and Miami? It doesn't matter. Could you go to the wire against any one of those schools for a high school recruit in the state of Florida? I think you could now. I think you could. I say that thinking about not the brand or the legacy of Florida State, Florida, Miami. I'm thinking more about where they're at currently. I think if I had to pick the best overall, at least from what I've seen, like raw recruiter of that crew, I think it's Norvell. I thought it was going to be Cristobal. I think it's Norvell. And I think that the UCF can claim to occupy the space. Look, you know, are you 5'11", saying you're 6 feet? Maybe, but you're not 5'2". And as long as all three aren't just absolutely humming like psychopath, like national title caliber, you know, level, and that's not going to happen all three at the same time, you're going to have space to operate in because you built up your own, you increased your own equity. You did the stadium, you did the conference realignment, you've done a fantastic job in marketing. I have a UCF jersey sitting in my home office, like, because they got into it with me on Twitter and we had fun with it. Like, they've done every single thing right in the intangible sense. In fact, I would argue that, like, you basically took a sitting head coach from the P4 last time in Gus. So why not? I think they might go younger next time. That could be a young head coach at another gig. I'm just saying, don't limit it to just the P4 head coaches. All of this, Christopher, you should imply that they can shop in really good aisles. Are they going to get Kirby from Georgia? No, but like, they're going to do very well. And it is going to be a line out the door with those resources and that ability to go and recruit Florida. You just have to keep it going. We're now, and it's so weird for me to say this, but we're now at a phase, at a point, they would need to make noise in a playoff sense. Really, actually, that's all we're missing. I'm going to interrupt myself. If UCF were to win the Big 12 or just get an at-large bid and maybe win a game in the playoff, I think the mentality amongst 18-year-olds, 16-year-olds who are being recruited by these schools is that they aren't going to look at them any different. And you can scoff if you're listening to this and you're a fan of those other three schools I keep mentioning, the Big Three. It's not about you. It's about what the 15 and 16 and 17-year-old sees. And two of those schools I mentioned are in a conference that might explode at any second. I mean, the Big 12 is just kind of packing on volume, but you got to feel like they're a safer bet at the moment than the ACC. I don't want to talk about realignment today. Michael, are Army and Navy essentially out of the playoff contention now that the committee won't take that game into account? No, Michael, I think you're just misreading that. Let's just pull out an example real fast. I'm going to use Navy because they play Notre Dame consistently. So let's just say Navy has a UCF level American Athletic Conference season, or a Houston, et cetera. You know, like they're in that at large position. They would have been that New Year's Six Bowl in the old system, but now, like, oh man, they're humming. They could grab that G5 spot. That, whether that happens or not, will not be affected at all by the Army Navy game. That's it. So in other words, Navy has a good year. Let's say, I don't have this year's schedule, it doesn't matter, but let's say that they have a decent non-conference game plus Notre Dame plus the American schedule, and they win the American. Maybe they've got one loss in there. They beat Notre Dame, and Notre Dame has like 10 or 11 wins in this scenario, and Navy is the G5 representative. Whether or not, whatever happens with Army won't matter. And does that make it as sort of is an exhibition game now? I guess you could say it is, but it's a pretty damn important exhibition game to those playing it. Certainly not in people, you know, the people playing it and the fans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they're not treating it like an exhibition game. This game is going to sit outside of the causation, you know, the chain of events that creates the playoff, because it's going to happen after the playoff is determined. So how do we feel about that? I don't have a feeling about it, to be honest. Army-Navy was never going to move. I don't think it should move. I think it occupies an incredibly unique spot on the calendar. I think it's an incredibly unique sporting event. It's inherently American. It's definitively American, whether you like the armed forces or not. Where it falls on the calendar, even more so. The sport of college football. I mean, like, that's the most American thing possible. And then, Army and Navy on top of it. I have no issue with this. I guess if you are a Rose Bowl stan and you have been looking to clap back at me since I went on my tirade, that you could say, well, why are you so in favor of this having that outlier special boy? Why does Army Navy get to be a special boy and the Rose Bowl doesn't? Why can't the Rose Bowl live and exist as a special boy too? Why must the Rose Bowl conform to the structure and the format of the season and the postseason and the advancement and the evolution of the playoff? But you're saying Army Navy can just live on this 13th week on Heisman Saturday and they can play and it doesn't matter technically or whatever. We love it. The short answer is the fucking Army Navy game has never tried to derail the postseason of college athletics. So I'm just going to go back to the same argument I did last time. If the Rose was just like, hey, we are the Rose, and this is just what we're going to do, and we're going to pull two teams, like, you can't even do it anymore because Pac-12 doesn't exist. But, like, yeah, if they wanted to step outside of the structure the way Army-Navy does, great. Do it. The problem is the Rose Bowl wanted to be the structure. They wanted to impede the advancement and evolution of a postseason playoff because they wanted to be the summit, which they kind of never were because bowls were always disputed. But they liked that format better than advancing anything else. Marshall, how is Clemson good at picking large people who tackle on the defensive line, but isn't good at picking large people who block on the offensive line? Marshall stumbled on something that's pretty amazing because I don't know off the top of my head if I could think of a greater disparity between an offensive and defensive line, both in terms of like the production, as in the stats that they've put up, but also the production and it, like the talent they've recruited and developed and turned into pros. Like, and then also just like rumors and vibes. I don't know if there's another like playoff caliber program, top 25 program, where it's you have such a disparity on the lines. I can't think of one. You might have had a couple examples year to year, but there is a weird, consistent thing where like Clemson's offensive line is kind of a problem, and Clemson's defensive line just keeps shooting dudes into the NFL. First thing let's look at, offensive line. Let's talk about the bad part of it first. We're going to have to hold conflicting ideas about Dabo through the whole conversation that we're about to have here. So good luck. And I'm not trying to stooge for Dabo. You could start from the development side and look at who the O-line coaches are. O-line coaches have become, I think, even more valued in the last couple of years, because O-line has been a trickier position to recruit. And I think that it has been, with the portal, a messier situation to manage. So having a really good O-line room and having a really fundamentally, almost like NFL, the way we talk about a knowledgeable head coach in the NFL, we're always talking about like how much football shit is in his head, right? Whereas in college, it's like, oh, he's a good coach, he's a good recruiter, he's the no. I think having an offensive mind at the O-line position is becoming more important. This is just a theory I'm working on, okay? And this is not to speak ill of Robbie Caldwell or Thomas Austin. Caldwell was there forever. And then Thomas Austin is a Dabo product. He's like what Dabo has been famous for and kind of bragged about and beat his chest about was like, oh, hey, we're going to keep it in house. We're going to keep everything in house. We're going to grow our own coaches. We're going to, you know, we're not going to get in the portal. We're not going to go hire outside minds. We're going to keep people on our staff. We're going to, you know, okay. Well, he's gone now because Matt Luke is there, the former Ole Miss head coach, the former O-line coach at Georgia. 28 sacks in back-to-back seasons is not good. The reticence to work the portal is not good at the offensive line position. The lack of sending a stellar talent into the NFL in the last couple seasons is not good. Can you, and I don't have all the numbers in front of me, this is more of a question I'm posing to the class. Clemson fans will know. Is it possible to look at O-line talent from Clemson overall and be able to mark their NFL trajectory against when Clemson was national title relevant and when they weren't? In other words, have you seen it drop as they've dropped a little bit out of the picture? I would bet you could. Having Luke in there again, I've praised him on more for the Dabo management stuff and him being an ex-head coach and then him also having a ton of SEC experience and sort of breaking out of that, like, I don't know what you want to call it. How do I say it nicely? Like the cult kind of mentality that Dabo has. I hate going back to Saban for everything, but it's just such an easy way to teach people things. Saban's system is that there, or was, sorry, past tense, Saban's system was not that anyone earned any, or anyone was assumed to have anything. The idea at Clemson was, you know, hey, you're going to start here and you would have a chance to move up and become a position coach and do that. None of that happened at Alabama with that sort of assumption or the kind of like a birthright mentality, because the system at Alabama was to just ruthlessly strip and evaluate it, strip everything down and evaluate it at the end of every season cycle and then rebuild it. And also they had so much transience as a coaching staff. We talked a lot in past episodes and years about how the transience took a toll on Alabama, but I would also argue that it helped them tremendously because they're bringing in new ideas. They're also bringing in a lot of recent NFL minds. They're also bringing in people who are more aggressive at recruiting positions like offensive line. So I don't have a single explanation for you as to why the O-line has been that bad, but I will say it, you have to, in order to give, to create the most honest answer here, it's all of the categories I just said. So it's it's not stellar level SEC level recruiting at that position in recent years. I think the development is a huge part, and maybe probably the category I would draw the most from. Then it's also the people coaching the offensive linemen, and then that speaks to the Dabo sort of culture thing. Does that make sense? It is a serious hindrance, and it is one of the reasons Luke has that job. Is it that's just the position right away? You got to go like, okay, yeah, they got to be better here. They just absolutely have to be better. So on the flip side, why are they so good at the other one? They're kind of good at the other. They're kind of good at the other one because of some of the Dabo shit. I don't know if I'm giving Dabo credit necessarily for the fact that Brent Venables was there for so long, but it certainly didn't help or didn't hurt. Like it's having a guy like that who's there so long, so consistently. It kind of makes sense, right? Like replacing him with Wes Goodwin, like the Wes Goodwin replacement thing, like that's working out for them. I'm not saying he's Brent Venables, but I'm saying we've pulled back and maybe you're taking if you have a casual eye on Clemson, you're like, oh, they're not as good as they were. But like Wes Goodwin has had a good transition. Nick Eason coming in a defensive tackles coach was a good move. I think all those guys got raises in the offseason. So it's just interesting to me because this is the kind of thing I just criticized Dabo for, right? You brought up essentially like a GA, I think, and he became the O-line coach after Caldwell was there way too long, and you hung on to him, and it's like, okay, well, what's Goodwin? He's been with the Tigers for I'm looking at his bio now, it's 14 years? So it's, I'm sitting here telling you, okay, well, the offensive line's bad because they never... they did the sort of Dabo cronyism and they didn't bring in any new ideas. Well, they replaced Brent Venables with another Clemson guy, but it worked. It worked. I think O-line is going to be the most anxiety... I think that position is going to cause the most anxiety for the most programs in college football until we change the format we're in right now. I think I feel pretty comfortable saying that. All right, guys, let's talk about Magic Mind. First off, magicmind.com/splitzone20. That's magicmind.com/splitzone and then 2 and 0 in the slash. You get 20% off your first order, okay? Split, that's the most important thing you're going to hear me say. You can get 48% off of your first subscription or 20% off of a one-time purchase if you guys go to that URL. All right, what's Magic Mind? It's been a little godsend for me. Let me tell you something. The ideal morning, you wake up. For me, I slept at least 7 hours, 20 to 30 minutes, about 7.5 hours. You get some sort of cardio or some sort of workout. You drink the appropriate amount of water. You have your nice cup or 2 or 3 of coffee, depending on your mileage. And then you fire off one of those Magic Minds. After that routine, you're headed to the office, you're headed to work, whatever. That's when I found Magic Mind to be the absolute best possible supplement for my day. Sharper mind, lower stress, better energy, a consistent focus. That's the best thing I can tell you. Now, what about the non-ideal days? You slept less than 6 hours because you decided to have human beings, which is a really bad idea sometimes. But, whatever. Apple of my eye. Love my children. You're a zombie. You didn't get a chance to work out. You really need to go do stuff. You've got to get through the day. Same thing applies. Take Magic Mind. It is a very consistent mental performance shot. It is going to give you a steady amount of caffeine, as well as a bunch of nootropics, a bunch of actual things that are good for you. It doesn't taste terrible. It's got vitamin C. It's got vitamin D3. It's got B12. These are the things that are going to help maintain a consistent focus for you throughout the day. Trust me, I wouldn't promote it if I didn't do it. I did it for a month. I love it. MagicMind.com/splitzone20. Finish off prepping your day with Magic Mind. Do it for 7 days. Get back to me. MagicMind.com/splitzone20. Ian, in general, do programs consider it a positive or a negative to share their metro with an NFL franchise? Some, like the Tigers and Saints and Cardinals and 49ers, have had close ties, but for others, it's non-existent or hostile. What causes college and pro team relations to be fruitful in some markets, but not in others? Ooh, okay. I picked this question because there isn't really a correct answer. Let's use that Tiger Saints example for a second. I don't think it's as kumbaya as you might think. In fact, I know it's not. Having spoken with people. The NFL doesn't have to care about anything. Ever. The NFL doesn't have to care about who wins the college football national championship. It doesn't care about if the Michigan-Ohio State game was good. It doesn't have to care at all. And it shows in so much of their business decision-making. And there's really no concern that the NFL has for any kind of symbiotic relationship. Just look at the TV world. I mean, my gosh, they're just eating into, I would even call it historical, but like God-given territory that college football occupies. We've talked about this on multiple shows. So understanding that, if you take a step down into the local level, it's going to go franchise by franchise. Now, one thing I have noticed working in sports for however many years I've done it, I would say there's more uniformity across franchises in the NFL than there are in any other major sport. Meaning that I think it's because of their success, the fact that they sit at the top of the mountain, there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of omerta, there's a lot of, I don't know why I just said that with like a Spanish accent, I don't know what the fuck that was about. There's a lot of regulations and there's a lot of self-policing. And so by and large, one NFL franchise to another is going to be roughly the same in how it deals with communities, et cetera, et cetera. And there are exceptions. I understand that. You don't get that with baseball, hockey, basketball. You can have sort of franchises that are hyper-focused in the community, less so, have a particular sort of disposition, have a reputation. The NFL is just more of a monolith. I think it behooves the NFL to play nice when you're talking on the franchise-to-franchise level with the local teams. Now, so Ian asking, are Tigers and Saints, LSU and the Saints. Louisiana is, you know, weirdly, for being a sort of literal and metaphorical gumbo, it's also a monoculture in sports. Not a lot of people move to Louisiana statistically. And so you're not going to like drive around a, you know, river ridge outside of New Orleans and see 20 or 30 different college football teams. You're certainly not going to see, it's going to be pretty much a blanketed Saints culture. So if you go to a city like Nashville or you go to, you know, Portland, Oregon, or you get it, the suburbs of Washington, D.C. or something like that, Lord knows what flags you're going to see flying. When I drive from my house to my office in Nashville, I've seen, I think I counted because I walked it the other day because the weather was nice, 7 Big Ten flags on houses. And there's two different neighborhoods. There's two neighborhoods, sort of my neighborhood, and then you cross and there's another neighborhood, and then there's my office. And the second neighborhood is much younger. And it's like post-college, everybody's kind of flying their stuff. And so you see the flags you would expect, and then you see the flags you wouldn't, like Illinois or UCLA. Two Michigans out, makes sense. They just won the national title. But that doesn't happen in a place like that. So when you have the monoculture, it's somewhat okay. If we're making a Venn diagram, in Louisiana, most people are going to cheer for LSU and the Saints. But behind closed doors, in little sort of ticky-tack ways, there, I guess I should also say this. In New Orleans, that's a really unique city, and the city of New Orleans thinks it is a nation. In other words, like there are people in New Orleans who would never leave New Orleans, who don't understand, like, I know I'm referencing the characters from Confederacy of Dunces, but it's also a fact. So things that happen in New Orleans are all that happens in the world. So there are people who are diehard Saints fans who just shrug at the idea of Baton Rouge and LSU. There's a weird elitism there. Most people who grow up in Baton Rouge or Lafayette or Lake Charles or even up, you know, towards Shreveport, whatever, yeah, they're probably LSU fans and Saints fans. The further north you get, they might be Cowboys fans. This is all a given, though. There's no, like, positive or negative to it. I think that there's a little bit of ego involved in certain regards of, you know, if you go into the city of New Orleans and say, or who's the soul of the city, they're going to say the Saints. They're not going to say LSU. If you go to different cities across the country, it's going to flip-flop between maybe an NFL team or a college team. It just depends on what kind of melting pot you're in, if you're in any kind of melting pot. The other example, talking about like Stanford, the Cardinal, I guess, and the 49ers, they just don't think that way. They're usually, that's a good example of two entities or two brands that are just courting different audiences. Stanford, in terms of an athletic department, a marketing arm, I would love to sit down with them and be like, who are you marketing your football to? Who are you marketing your athletic events to? You're in one of the, I think still the richest sort of like per home value, per square foot, richest parts of the country in Palo Alto. Not a lot of rank and file hanging out, okay? So who's filling up that stadium? Who are you marketing your softball games to? Whereas the 49ers border on such a large regional brand that they just don't have to concern themselves with Palo Alto. And if one's doing good, great. If one's not great, they kind of shrug it off. You might have intermingling in terms of staffs. Obviously, you can go back to the LSU Saints thing, Joe Brady, et cetera. There are weird relationships that form with coaching staffs that you probably don't hear too much about. Like, oh, what's a good example? Okay, when Jeff Collins was the head coach at Georgia Tech, one of his best friends in the world, Matt Rhule, is the head coach of the Carolina Panthers. And so are they gonna talk shop and compare notes and just, you know, kind of fraternize? Yeah, but like you don't really put that on Front Street when you're, you know, a couple blocks over from Mercedes-Benz Stadium in the Atlanta Falcons that you're buddies with this staff. Like that stuff happens organically. In terms of the pure marketability, let's look at something like Washington for a second. Washington is going to, I'm sorry, I should say that the Huskies are the Washington Huskies. I mean, look, I still don't call them Commanders. I really have actually fallen into just calling them the Washington football team. But the Seahawks and UW can sit in the actual same city and probably never really bump into each other or feel like one is a hindrance. I think if anything, when Seattle, UW is a good example because when UW recruits and the recruits are from more than, let's say, 200 or 300 miles away, which happens a lot, right? Like Los Angeles, or they recruit somebody from Texas, or, I mean, you know, you're recruiting all over when you're in the Pacific Northwest, you're flying kids in. I think the energy of being an NFL city helps. Definitely. I think there's a stronger together sort of vibe about Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. It's not as necessary now because the world is a much smaller place in the post-millennial culture. But as someone who's read something like 4 books on the oral history or the hidden history of the grunge movement in Seattle, going back to like 85, there was an idea of like DIY and community support that existed in cities like Seattle and Portland in a way that we can't really understand in other parts of the country because they were cut off from everywhere else. There were metros. There were big cities. I mean, like, you'd be cut off in Montana, but you're probably in a town of nothing, right? These were metro cities, big cities that, you know, in the case of the music thing, like, touring bands just wouldn't go up there because they didn't think it was financially worth it. Because I think it's 11 hours from Minneapolis and it's like 7 hours from the Bay. I just made that up, but I know it's like, it's far away. And so that's why they developed their own thing. And so when you meet native, like, Washingtonians, I mean, yes, you have Wazoo fans, you have UW fans, you like have a lot of Oregon fans that live in Seattle. So you have that typical college football tribalism, but I don't think any of them have ever pointed to the Seahawks as a hindrance in any way, shape, or form. I've never come across that in my career. So I kind of picked this question from Ian just because it's something I never really thought of before, and I don't really know if I have an answer for it. The last thing I'll say is this. I know this happens because I see it happen every fucking year, where a dominant college brand just assumes that I'm looking straight at you, Athens. They're like, why doesn't the local team just draft nothing but our guys? And the two places I see this where I hear the most complaints are LSU fans and the Saints and Georgia fans and the Falcons. And it happens in other markets for sure, but it happens the most there. And I don't necessarily think it happens quite the same way with like Penn State, for instance, or like Ohio State. It's because you have two pro teams in those states, two NFL teams, I should say. Right. So, one could argue, and I don't know if this is technically true, but there are as many or close to it OSU fans in Cincinnati as there are in the greater Cleveland, Northeast Ohio area. So when something like Joe Burrow happens, I think Ohio State fans still cheer for Joe Burrow, right? Yeah, I'm sure they do. I just had to pause there for a second, but I'm sure that works. It's great, but there's also still the Cleveland Browns. So something about, like I said, Falcons, Dogs, and LSU and the Saints. It's also because those two schools, LSU and Georgia, have pumped out so many NFL players in the last 15, 20 years. Personnel directors don't think like that, guys. They don't. And I know that, this happens to anyone with a favorite college football team. You're like, oh man, I hope he ends up on my NFL team if I have one, or an NFL team I like. But personnel directors are agnostic. You know, NFL scouts are agnostic. They don't think like that. So it's weird because you have something like the Eagles phenomenon happen where they take a bunch of Georgia guys. And so you'll have Georgia fans like kind of leaning in and like, oh, I want to check in on the Eagles game. But some of that's happenstance. Some of it just happens to be weird. Sometimes there's a connection there. But, you know, the idea of like all these Texas players are going to go to the Texans, like that's just, it's kind of 1960s thinking. Too much risk involved in the NFL to have the bias of just going local. Also, I would be really curious there's no way to extrapolate this, I don't think, but like, what's the data? What's the return on that? I don't think the Falcons saw any pop from Todd Gurley being the starting running back off the top of my head. Okay, there is one that I think it would be an outlier case, though. Had Peyton signed with the Titans instead of the Broncos, that franchise would look a lot different. I don't even mean like the Super Bowl's part of it or if they would have gone to a Super Bowl, but yeah. But he was like, he is the player of the state university in Tennessee going to a still nascent NFL franchise. Still young in the broader scheme of NFL franchises. I'm sure it would help if like the next great scrawny running back went to Green Bay, but I also think Packers fans are going to be Packers fans and it don't matter, you know? Are there Bears fans out there that are like, we need more Lion Eye? I don't think so. Aiden Hutchinson helped the Lions thing. That was cool to see. I don't hate Michigan every day of the week. Like, that's cool to see, like, native. That's always cool to see. But it's not something that anyone's ever going to lean into or do, like, specifically. Matt, what are the origins of, or perhaps reasons for, BYU's often earned reputation for dirty play? Okay. Reasons and reputation are, we're talking fact or perception, because there used to be fact. Like, it used to just be a thing I didn't really have to argue, and I learned it from coaches, and you could learn it from the television, hell. I would say, weirdly, because he's such a soft-spoken, nice guy, that the Bronco Mendenhall era was probably like it's when the sort of dirtiness culture gelled. There's a ton of reasons for this. It's a whole thing. There's a quote, and I always butcher the name. Is it Deseret News? It's not Deseret. That wouldn't sound right. It's a newspaper in Utah. There's an old quote from Mendenhall that I pulled up to answer this. I want to see if I can find the year just to give you guys like a sort of, I can't find the year. Don't worry about it. It's when Mendenhall was at BYU. That's all you need to know. Quote, when I've seen BYU play at its best, the teams I've watched in the past, they are physically dominant. They are tough. They are on the edge of playing within the rules because they are so aggressive, end quote. So, yeah, that's why. Mendenhall, for being such a soft-spoken, nice guy, is a fucking defensive coordinator, man. What do you want? They're going to get in there, and they have some limitations. Look, this is not uncommon for any program or culture that has to set its identity by its limitations. BYU is maybe not, it's uniquely limited. LDS, who you recruit, what they have to do on campus, do they want to lead that life? Players going on missions and coming back, and they have families, and like I don't have to run down all the things that make BYU unique compared to the average state university that's playing FBS football. But there are limitations when you compare BYU to, you know, USC or Texas or Florida State or something. And anytime you have limitations, you tend to build a chip on your shoulder in some way, shape, or form, or you run the triple. I think that's the core of it. But for a long time, this wasn't even in debate. This wasn't something where I'm like, it's the vibe, or that's the identity, or any of that kind of stuff. They were just statistically a highly penalized team. It just happened a lot. It has not happened. There were multiple stories. We did stories at SB Nation about it. And then it did, like, the Satake era has, I would say, curtailed that some. I'm not saying it doesn't happen anymore. I'm saying it's just not the way it used to be. I've not checked penalty. Total penalty stats are like kind of wonky because I was looking them up earlier and I was getting conflicting numbers. I think it's just how they're tallied, or maybe it's incomplete data. But you can go back and look at those Mendenhall teams, like headhunting, nut gouge, stomach punch after the call, late getting off the dog pile. I mean, this is the culture of the Miami Beach Bowl brawl with Memphis, right? That's a fairly famous thing. I don't know. Maybe, again, someone's new to the sport. They don't know what I'm talking about. Go back. Just get on YouTube, and it's BYU Memphis brawl. And it's funny because, like, you got the young black Memphis, oh, they're thuggy perception, and then you watch that video. You're like, holy shit. Crew-cutted white boys are mean as shit. I can't give an origin without, I feel like, maybe leaning too hard into a stereotype or an assumption. But I do feel like there's a weird thing that happens where you just, I think Mormons and LDS get made fun of a lot. And I think that BYU gets made fun of a lot. And I think BYU, look, for reasons that BYU promotes and endorses, carries a stigma or whatever. And I think the football players themselves get sick of hearing that shit. And I think that's a big part of it and always has been. But I also think specifically Mendenhall did tap into a sort of particular thing about them where it was like, I'm going to beat your ass physically. I'm going to beat your ass when you're on the ground. If two or three guys fall in a pile and the play somewhere else or whatever, I'm going to give you a little bit of English there at the end so you know I was here. And it's just that sort of psychological kind of warfare thing. So that's not as satisfying an answer as possible, but it's not something where it's like a myth by any stretch. But it's also not something that I would say you could like flick on a BYU game this year and maybe see it. And like, to me, in watching BYU, it has not been the kind of like casually, quickly identified dirtiness of years past. By the way, the team I hear that's the dirtiest all the time is when I talk to MAC coaches, they talk about Eastern Michigan. Like, take that for what it's worth. It's not necessarily an insult. It's not necessarily like a negative. They're like, yeah, those guys are fucking dirty. It's not like, oh, those guys are dirty. We don't want to play them. It's like, wow, we got to play these guys and they're fucking dirty. It's a weird trade-off of it. They're not really ascribing a value to it or a moral judgment, I should say. Dirty does not come with a moral judgment in football often. Chris, how does college football die? We've seen the rise of football, college football and the NFL, to the top of the American sports food chain over the last 20-odd years, and it seems like we may see the wave cresting soon, if not already. What factors? And he put in parentheses, waning attention, media greed, consolidation, regulation, etc., combined to take the sport down to a shadow of its current self. Feel free to speculate wildly. Chris, I only included this question to be a huge tease and say, stay tuned. Chris's question was, how does college football die? Stay tuned. That's all I'm going to say. It's going to drive you nuts. I'm not going to say anything else at all. Your boy's working on something. Okay? All right, let's move it over. Benny and the Jets, that's the username. He went with Benny and the Jets. Look, I love Elton John. It's not a timely reference for a username. Also, Benny and the Jets, it's a soft rock radio banger. It's not on Tumbleweed Connection. I've been loving the one-hour deep dive episodes that y'all have been doing this offseason. If we have a question, topic, or research request, what's the best way to submit? We have not done it that way, Benny and the Jets. In other words, we haven't really taken suggestions. We just kind of kicked them around. Next time I open a single wing thread, you just say, hey, what, you know, for the one-hour show, maybe. Yeah. We kind of played around with the format in the dead of the offseason. You know, we're in... The way the SCD calendar has gone the last couple of years, it's like, this is really going to change next year, because if you want to get freaked out, go find out when the national championship is next year. So in February, when football is over, you have, I think, a sort of react and respond month, and you're still sort of clinging to things that are happening in that way. But I think this year around February, we started doing the single topic episodes, which is something that could stand alone. I remember I did the whole Mac coaching thing. That was the first one that I had submitted to the guys. And we just all took turns, the three of us, bringing a topic that we would discuss for, and you know, 45 minutes, something like that, rather than just being like, here are the headlines this week. And like, nothing's really going on. The idea was that like you could listen to three shows from February or March when they came out, or you listen to them right now, and they would still have relevance, and they'd still be enjoyable. Because we know that off-season consumption patterns are very different for obvious reasons. It's the off-season. So we did that for a little while, and then now we're kind of in a different mode, which is like the summer. It's not summer vacation, because we're still making stuff, but this is where the three of us, like our schedules diverge. I'm working on multiple projects right now. Richard's transitioning through like work stuff, and Alex has got stuff going on. Okay, I just keep having to say stuff because I never know what I can announce or when. And so this is where, you know, single wing comes in handy, because I can just bang one out wherever I am on the road, right? We're kind of apart from one another, so it gets loose in the summer, but we kind of like it that way. And we sort of do stuff that's more standalone or one-off or weird until the end of June. So it's like mid-May as I record this, end of June. Like this is the time of year to have the most fun and get weird, unless there's like a Red River to the SEC. And then once you're back from the 4th of July, like shit's on. Y'all know that. Like that's what you're gearing in. I got an invitation to go to the Mountain West Media Days, and it was like July 10th. I'm not going, but like, Jesus. July 10th. Isaac, as a guy who runs a business spread out over a continent, any tips on working remote over multiple time zones? No, I included this question because it fucks me up a lot, Isaac. On the now famous iPad, I have, are they called widgets now? Of just the Apple widget for the clocks, and I still fuck it up. And it's not because I have a co-host in LA and a co-host in New York and I live in Nashville. It's because, like, that's I can manage that. I'm not a simpleton. But right now I'm working on a project where I have a producer. I'm working with two Americans in England right now, multiple people in Los Angeles. And I had to set up a meeting this week with someone. I have no fucking idea what time it is in Arizona ever. I don't know what y'all's problem is. But I've had to schedule 3 calls with Arizona people. What a fucking nightmare that is. Anyways, I've had to schedule something with like multiple calls with some individuals that are based in London and completely duffed a Zoom 2 weeks ago because the person was like, hey, we'll do it at this time, whatever. And I keep London time on my screen, like next to like the ones I use the most are like, I don't need fucking Eastern. I had an hour, but then it's like Central, Pacific, and London. But then there's something called BST, which is British Summertime, which is a sort of fake time zone they create for themselves, I guess, because they only get natural light for 6 weeks a year. Missed the call. The Apple clock didn't know it. So it's been a pain in the ass. I don't have a good... I got nothing, Isaac. It's fucking annoying. Jason, I'm 42 and I got diagnosed with ADHD in the last 6 months. Any advice, particularly as it relates to anxiety? I'm pretty new at this, so anything helps. All right, Jason, get ready to do the sampler platter. So let's do this sort of idea of like you're walking into a brewery. It doesn't have to be alcohol, a juice bar, and you get the flight. You are at some point going to have to go through the flight of options for management because ADHD is nothing if not bespoke. Also, don't worry about being 42 and just now getting diagnosed. It's better than dying with it. I mean, I'm serious. It's better to do it now than live the rest of your life and not know what the hell's going on or not understand why your brain is patterned a certain way. There's nothing wrong with checking it at 42. So don't worry about that. Advice as it relates to anxiety. I'm pretty new at this, so anything helps. The first thing I'm not going to do is give you any medical advice on prescription drugs. So I can tell you that I no longer take anything that has amphetamine in it. I can get into that in a later episode. I don't really feel the need to. But as someone with like a pretty healthy history of abuse, I didn't want to do... And also just a genetic Christmas tree of alcoholism and addiction. Holy shit. I mean, it's everywhere. I wanted to get off amphetamine and worked with a doctor to do that years ago now. It's been a long time, actually, now that I think about that. But I had to make modifications to do that, and I've had to change things to do that. It may work gangbusters for you. There's also like 7 different ways to do it. It's not just like college kids pumping Adderall anymore. There's a whole different things that are available with extended release and stuff that's not amphetamine based. And so this is where you need to go to a doctor with the diagnosis. And then that's the whole kind of sampler platter thing. Cause you're going to try something, you're going to let it get in your bloodstream for a little while in your brain for a month or two. And then you're going to figure out, I like this, I don't like this, it's causing this, et cetera. Hey, maybe we should modify the dosage, or we should maybe try a different prescription. That's the shitty part about this, but it's just 100% necessary that you continue. It's not failure to change meds. It's not. The anxiety part is manageable if you are dogged. The easiest thing that you can do tomorrow to curb your anxiety is to sleep, raise your heart rate for 30 minutes a day in some way, shape, or form. And if you don't work out at all, go for a walk and then go to a gym and get on a treadmill and then maybe find an elliptical or a Stairmaster and go from there, whatever. Sleep and raising your heart rate are the basic things. Caffeine consumption is the second thing I would say. I obviously drink a lot of coffee. I talk about coffee all the time, but I am pretty religious now on when I drink and how much. Third is, what would I put third for you? I could say dietary, but that's just going to open a whole other door, and we're going to keep it really simple right now. If you're raising your heart rate and you're monitoring your sleep, and you're checking that you don't have any caffeine in your system after a certain time of day so that you can then continue. See, the reason sleep is so important is you're going to emotionally regulate that way. And so I'm talking less about the ADHD and more about the anxiety. So with proper sleep, the wave of anxiety that feels like it can normally knock you off your feet is going to come in and just sort of brush past your ankles like you're standing in the Gulf, okay? That's the metaphor I want you to think about. But that only happens if you sleep and you hydrate and you stay on a good schedule. The third thing that I would recommend before you do anything else is to disengage from a screen as much as you can after a certain point in the day. I'm not an idiot, dude. I make my entire living on screens. But if you can have an extended block of time where you are not receiving information, your ADHD is going to help self-manage because your brain is not working in a linear way. But so your brain is probably always seeking something. It always probably, if your brain's like mine, if it's an ADHD like mine, your brain wants to be receiving something at all times. If you can break that off for a little while, in the absence of receiving information, stimulation, et cetera, you're going to be able to kind of do the, like, do you remember when you'd have, everybody had those computers, the towers, like the gateways and Dells, and you would defragment your hard drive? Do people still do that? That's what your brain does when you're not receiving the stimulation. It defragments. By the way, another way to do this is meditation. You have probably heard all of the things I've just said in some way, shape, or form. But if you can try them out in that order, it will start to slowly change. Nothing I've said is going to flip a switch off. You will live with the anxiety for the rest of your life, but the severity, frequency, and impact it has are all knobs that you can find and adjust. I promise. I hope that helps. Oh, Dylan. Dillion? Dillion? There's an extra I? On a scale of awful to unwatchable, how bad is the Aaron Sorkin January 6th movie going to be? Is this a thing? Is this how I find out? I'm not Googling it. God damn. Whew. I'm not watching that. If I was very proud of the response that we got to Juice the last couple days of Charity Bowl this year. The EDSBS Charity Bowl for New American Pathways. Channel 6, Holly Anderson, Spencer Hall. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go over there and give some money. I was very happy with the way that I was able to juice it at the end and play the, and we did like a very kayfabe Michigan thing. And so I have to, by the way, people were asking, when are you doing the Michigan show? Or it's Michigan and Rose Bowl because I think they hit the stretch goal. Probably late summer, I think. I don't know. Because I want it to be fun and good, and maybe have guests. I don't know. I got to figure that out. But I do owe it, and look, I know it. I got a marker. But if I hadn't done that, it was just such an obvious, easy way to do it. And I don't like. I mean, I don't regret it, but I would have offered up, like, I will watch the entire season in the newsroom and give a book report on it. Because I've only seen clips and like maybe back when channel surfing still existed, which was when the newsroom was on, like sort of floated past an episode and just felt a total revulsion. And there's actors on that show I like. I mean, Jeff Bridges is a great actor, right? It's Jeff Daniels. Sorry. Jeff Daniels, good actor. Jeff Bridges, Jeff Daniels. What are you going to do? One was the dude. One was in Dumb and Dumber. I don't mind him. He's really good in certain roles. He really is. Boy, he's in that new Tom Wolfe thing on Netflix. It looks fucking heinous. Anyway. Olivia Munn. Dude from David Harbour, I love, from Stranger Things. All good. All good. That's a fucking terrible show. Holy shit. I recently have rewatched The Social Network. To watch Fincher match Sorkin's dialogue. And I couldn't figure out what I appreciate so much about that movie because the subject matter I don't give a flying fuck about. But there's something you appreciate about that film. And it's just, if you can limit Sorkin to a screenwriter, he's really amazing. I cast no stone. I don't know if I could do it. There's no way I could do it the way he does it. It's just a moralizing thing. I don't know. I used to bang on a sports night in college. Does anybody remember Sports Night? It was Aaron Sorkin sitcomish, like kind of. It was a 30-minute show, I think, about the like working on the set of like essentially like a Sports Center show. It was great. I'm not totally anti-story. I fucking hate the West Wing. It's just, maybe it's the politics thing. I don't know. Man, I know so many journalists that love the West Wing. It's probably what's wrong with journalism. Just that. That's it. This next person, he said he didn't mind attribution, but I mean, whatever. No reason to say it. Next person. I got laid off in December, and I've been unemployed and searching since. I'm a social science researcher working primarily in higher education. It's been an absolute grind and an emotional roller coaster. Some days, not having anywhere in particular to be is an absolute blast. Or the satisfaction I get from using old construction skills on a side hustle feels really good. That's awesome. Other days, the stream of "we regret to inform you" emails and constant financial stress make me want to hide in a dark room and never come out. I know that you've had some tough career phases. So what do you have? What do you have? Yes. For someone who knows, quote, "this too shall pass," but is barely hanging on in the day to day. I've had an illustrious career, my friend. I have been fired from a professional wrestling organization. I laid off. They eliminated the position, and then they recreated the position for a freelancer. Does that mean I got fired? Like, there's two people in that company that really wanted to fire me, though. So let's just say I got fired. Got fired a bunch when I was younger, but it was like not like life, you know. Got fired from the college radio station. Whatever. I think I got fired from there twice. Got kicked out of college twice. Okay. Routine. Don't ride the high wave of there's nothing to do and it feels good, because the valley will come, because your conscience is working overtime here based on the way you phrase your question to me. So you're justifying those days of like, oh, there's nothing to do, this is great, but you, in the back of your head is not turning off. So you establish a routine. And the routine will help you set some expectations. So if in that routine you're working on job strategy stuff 2 hours a day, whatever, it could be 4 hours, I don't know, whatever that time it is that you allot to it, at the end of it, in the absence of of the accomplishment that you seek, you can justifiably, incredibly tell yourself, I did this work today to get myself to the better position. That's how you have to look at these days. The construction thing I'm interested in, I have one of my best friends was able to do that when he was, like, he dropped out of college. He didn't get kicked out like I did. He dropped out. They worked construction for a couple of years, and he's like a pretty good amateur carpenter. Could get a job. Like, if they were, you know, framing a house tomorrow, he'd go get a job. Like, do it. He's long since changed careers. But, like, I always was jealous of, like, man, like, I absolutely should have gone to trade school instead of college. But anyway, the idea of getting out there and doing work and physical labor can't be bad right now. If you're giving yourself some time every single day or week or however you want to structure it again to the pursuit of finding the next job, getting out and being constructive is constructive in construction is only a net positive. So I like the idea of leaning into that. I think you're suffering from the sort of idle hands mentally. And so the more that you fill up the time with the structure is good. The less spiraling or sort of cycling, everyone has a different name for it, where you're sort of in the loop of looking at the emails, feeling distressed, looking for a short-term solution to a long-term problem, and then repeating that loop, feeling distressed over and over again, that's not going to help. This too shall pass. Yes, that's true. But if you're barely hanging on in the day to day, I want you to establish a routine, and I want you to stick to it as much as possible. And yeah, if you can go outdoors or you can do like some construction work or something like that, it's going to help. The rest is going to be a doggedness and a frequency of looking and searching and finding something. And also, man, what a good opportunity. I don't know if you have kids. I don't know what the deal is. Like, but, and I know you have financial stress, but like, what a fucking great opportunity to go to a library and read every day. Seriously. like find something that you could improve on in this period of time that's free, the knowledge based essentially, and do it. I would. Jack, any recommendations for overcoming imposter syndrome? Jack, we keep a tweet for this from one Spencer Hall. I think it's pinned on his account. It is from 2016. It is old. That is an old tweet. The tweet reads, again, follow your dreams because unqualified idiots are paid to do things they shouldn't be doing every day. Why not you? I can tell you right now that it's a very, very real thing that has absolutely no business existing, and that's imposter syndrome. And I am saying that as I am going through it right now on a project that I have no idea if I'm good at. And I don't know if I should finish. Well, I'm going to finish it because I have a contract. But I fight that all the time. I don't want... if you're listening to this and you're thinking like... I wouldn't want you to think that I'm passing off something that I don't feel myself. But I 110% keep going. Even when it's really hard. There's some sort of correlation or like almost like a formula where when it comes to imposter syndrome specifically, when it feels the strongest or the worst, if you will, and you can keep doing it on those like strongest and hardest and worst days. I just experienced this 2 days ago. You come out of it more convinced that you can finish the work, finish the deal, do the thing, whatever, then there's no other way to do it. There's no other better way to sort of like, I don't want to say trick your brain, because you're not tricking your brain. You're doing the thing. You're actually doing the thing. It's hard. This is why I picked this as the last question today. I had some other stuff, but we'll get to them on the remaining single wings. There is no cure for this. Our brains are wired to do this against us. And I can tell you this. I've been in the room. Look, I don't want to turn this into a political thing. It's not. But I was in the gym this morning and I saw like Tommy Tuberville standing behind, I think it was like Trump or something, on like a TV on mute. And like, I don't think he's in line for the nuclear codes. We'd have to get into some serious designated survivor shit. But that motherfucker's in Congress, right? What? What? I spent 8 days with that guy in September of 14. 8 days. And this guy's in charge of the country, like to a significant degree, can influence and introduce and create and push policy. This has nothing to do with his party affiliation, just for the purpose of this conversation. I know how smart that man is. I know how smart that man isn't. I spent 8 days with him. And my takeaway is that that man fucking never thought for a second that he could not run for political office. That man never for a second thought, I'm not qualified for this. Not for a second. Let that sink in. He's a senator. I just double checked. Motherfucker's a senator. I could tell you stories from that week and it would terrify you. And again, this is an apolitical statement. This is just about acumen and capacity and cognizance. Like, and that dude never thought once, like, I don't know if I'm capable of this. So go to bed tonight. And whatever it is you have imposter syndrome about, know for a fucking fact that whatever it is on earth, Tommy Tuberville would have no qualms doing it and feeling and telling people he was fucking good at it. I'm not saying be like Tommy Tuberville. I'm not doing a glib thing in the show. But know that these people are all around you. And you're probably smarter than them. But that's the burden and you didn't make it. Your brain did. Your mind's not your friend. It created the shackles that you put on yourself. Now you put them on yourself. Your mind introduced the thought that I'm not good enough to do this. I'm a fucking professional writer. I've been at war with my mind since, I don't know, 17. My record's not great. We're sub 500 here, folks. But don't quit. Tommy Tuberville would not quit. I hope you're a fucking astronaut. I hope I have one astronaut that listens to this show. Jack, I hope you're an astronaut, and I hope that you are not at all concerned or worried that you shouldn't be a fucking astronaut, because Tommy Tuberville would go to space tomorrow. My name is Stephen Godfrey at 38 Godfrey on all social media platforms. If you have an anonymous question for an upcoming show and you would just like to ask, it's sensitive, it can be mental health, family, fatherhood, motherhood, parenthood, whatever. Godfrey@splitzoneduo.com. I won't use any of your information. I know some people don't like to ask the really sort of sensitive stuff on the Substack chat forum because the names and avatars and stuff are associated. Totally fine. Godfrey@splitzoneduo.com. Go straight to my inbox. And then I use it and delete it. All good. I've been keeping sources secret for 20 odd years, so you can trust me. At least in that regard. Until next Friday, magicmind.com/splitzone20. I am your parasocial pal. I'll see you next week.